Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. I think this is the 10th night, and let me just check that. Yes, it is. And there are 5 streams tonight. In about an hour from now, it will be Nick's GLV, and then 2 hours from now, Bitcoin Flavius, and 4 hours from now, John Morgan, and 6 hours from now, The Distributist. So quite a lot coming up. I wouldn't be surprised if the schedule slides somewhat, but I'll do what I can. In the meantime, I'm here with Jared Taylor. Now, obviously, Jared is a prominent face in our circles. I don't think he needs any introduction, but welcome, Jared, to Millennial.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad I have you at the beginning of this marathon. I'm sure you'll be fresh and springy and your mind will be working like the smooth precision-built instrument it is.
Well, thank you very much. I'll try not to let you down. So I think it is worth saying that there's an image change and you've grown a mustache this year. I don't think you had it last year.
No, I didn't, and the reviews are certainly mixed. Some of the young lads have complimented me, saying that Taylor has gone full dictator. I'm not sure I care for that, but I suppose it's a compliment of sorts.
All right, it's certainly distinctive. I think it's authoritative. Okay, so before we went on air, you were saying that you think that there are signs of hope in America. Obviously, the situation just now is very dark, and people, it would be nice to hear of some positivity. So please take it away.
Well, in the United States, as you know, critical race theory has slithered out of the universities, which gave birth to it. And now corporations and even public schools are trying to cram it down the throats of white people. And one of the theories of critical race theory is that white people are inherently oppressors, and that for millennia, all we've ever done is run around and make life miserable for everyone who's not like us. But white people are actually fighting back against this, and in some cases, quite effectively. And this is the first time that I can remember ordinary white people. These are mothers who are PTA, Parent Teacher Association members, going to school boards and saying, no, you are not going to be telling my children that they are inherently bad because they are white. You're not going to do that. And they've been organizing to vote people off of school boards. And also there have been state legislatures in the United States that have passed laws banning this kind of teaching in public schools. And people who are prominent media personalities who have sent their children to private schools have, in a very public way, withdrawn their children from these schools, saying that what they're teaching is poisonous. And although this is a defensive reaction, and we as whites really need to go on the offensive and assert our rights, but at least this is an example of white people actually saying, well, no, we will not stand for this. This is against us. I mean, sometimes it's couched in a somewhat namby-pamby way as being, well, this is divisive. This teaches Americans to hate each other. But enough are actually saying, well, this is anti-white, and we won't stand for it. I consider that a very encouraging sign. It wouldn't have surprised me if Americans, by and large, had sat completely still for this sort of thing. And it's gratifying to me that they have not. Another is that despite a very concerted bans on websites and YouTube channels that are being blasted and all sorts of social media suppression, I think clearly more and more white people are finding voices like yours and mine. That's certainly my impression here in the United States. Our web traffic is increasing despite the very vigorous efforts that Google makes to suppress us. The difference between what you get if you quote a series of words from one of our articles in a Google search and a DuckDuckGo search, for example, is remarkable. A DuckDuckGo search has us right at the top where we should be. Google may not have us there at all, maybe pages and pages into their results. But despite this, people are finding us. And I think it's because white people are confused, they're wounded, they're hurt. They, for years, have been trying to be as racially fair-minded as possible, and they are battered at every turn by people who seem to think that the United States is this vicious white supremacist society where white people poison the air just by breathing. And they're fed up with that. So despite all of these efforts to silence us, I get the sense that white people are being more willing to question the authorities, even revile the authorities. And all of this I find very encouraging.
To get to the backlash against critical race theory, what do you think triggered that? Why do you think that has changed?
When people actually make decisions about where they live or where they go to school, most white people act just like readers of American Renaissance, my website. And as the great wit and wag Joe Soblin once said, in their mating and migratory habits, liberals are indistinguishable from members of the Ku Klux Klan. So in their own lives, white people, no matter what they say about the joys of diversity, they don't buy houses in majority non-white neighborhoods. No, they don't send their children to ghetto schools. None of that sort of thing. And so when the people who are organizing our society start telling their children that they are somehow inherently unworthy, that gets their backs up, and then they begin to move. And so these are PTA mothers who may not have any systemic understanding of race or any knowledge about the demographic future of the United States or Europe. They may not know really much about what happened to Europe in 2015 with a million Muslims pouring into Germany, a million and a half, whatever it is. But when you actually touch them where it matters, in their families, then they begin to see red. And this is, I think, it can be a point of departure for a little curiosity about the internet. The other thing was, of course, the astonishing excesses of 2020 in the United States with all this BLM rioting. Most whites just looked aghast at, for the first time, race riots happening not just in the black areas, but in some of the most fashionable retail addresses in the entire United States. Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills, Fifth Avenue in New York City, the Magnificent Mile in Chicago. These are very, very high-end retail areas, repeatedly sacked. And this is an astonishing thing for whites who, as I say, have really spent the last several decades doing their best to be fair-minded on race relations, thinking they were good people. And then all of a sudden, their neighborhoods, not necessarily their neighborhoods, but the best neighborhoods in America are being torn up by these people rioting as if every time they turned around, black people were being attacked or lynched by mobs of whites. This is just an astonishing and eye-opening experience. And I think it makes people think. Most people, it takes something as extraordinary to make them think, and for a very large number, even something like the BLM riots, even something like critical race theory, doesn't make them think very much, but it's certainly pushing them in our direction.
Yeah, I think, would you say that something that also triggered, inspired
Why not
white
triggered?
People? I just don't want to couch it in the wrong way. Something that also angered white people was seeing these riots being justified on the media and excused and even defended and supported by pundits and politicians. That surely must have been astonishing for someone who wasn't aware of the situation, like the situation rising over the last 10 years or so.
Yes. The way the media has treated all of this has appalled huge numbers of people. And just today, I was reading a Washington Post article. It reported on the arrest of six people who have been attacking Asians and robbing them deliberately. This is a gang that apparently has victimized 100 and 150 different elderly Asian women. and they track them down and watch their movements, and they go after women who work in Asian grocery stores or beauty parlors and who are likely to be carrying lots of cash after the end of the day's work. And the Washington Post reports on the happy arrest of these half dozen malefactors and even mentions that they're accused of committing hate crimes without ever mentioning their race. And of course, everyone knows that they are Black. And this in an article that Gunn then goes on to say that this is a positive development in the face of a string of anti-Asian activities that have just been burgeoning in the last year or so. And they go on to list a few, all of them in the passive voice. An elderly Asian man is knocked down and died. An elderly woman is run over by a car by someone shouting racial slurs. And then the only time they ever mentioned race was they managed to find some white woman, and they specify white woman, who apparently went up to an Asian man and spat on him and said, "Go back to where you came from." Well, okay, how horrible. The impression that they're clearly trying to give, this is all white people. Now, this would be bad enough, but even the readers of the Washington Post, which, as I'm sure your listeners and viewers know, is one of the most resolutely blinkered liberal and progressive media organs in the United States, even their readers are having none of this. Their readers in the comments section are saying, "What is this baloney? We know very well that these are Black people doing this. You can even tell from the names, the half a dozen they arrested, they actually mentioned the names. No white person would have a name like this."
Was it like Deshaun and
that kind of thing? Even more astonishing, unpronounceable things. At least I didn't detect any apostrophes in them. You know, that's a fashionable thing among our dusky brethren. They like to put apostrophes into their names. But in any case, even the readers of the Washington Post are fed up with this. So all of this is very positive. Now, how far it will go, it's very difficult to say. I like to imagine an organization like mine, American Renaissance, with just millions of followers and viewers, had we not been kicked off all the major platforms. But we do what we can. And fortunately, there are alternative platforms. And it seems to me that these baffled and surprised and frustrated white people are increasingly bestirring themselves to try to look in somewhat obscure corners of the internet to really find out if someone has been thinking about these things. And when they do, they're very, very pleased. We get comments from people saying, "My gosh, you know, I had no idea. And you've opened my eyes. And this is all quite astonishing and terrible." So I'm optimistic. Of course, for years, I've been thinking that the left has been overplaying its hand and that white people would wake up. And for years, I've been wrong. Well, maybe I'm right this time. Who knows?
In your own words, what is critical race theory? Because I ask you this, it might be good to get, Jared Taylor summarizes critical race theory clip. I can imagine people wanted to share that around. But also, it is something that is... what's the word? Not obfuscated, but whenever it comes up in the news, they say some nonsense like, "Well, it's just in the legal realm," but that's obviously not true. Otherwise, they wouldn't be asking for the right to indoctrinate kids with it in the education realm. But yes. they somehow simultaneously insist that it's only in the legal realm, whilst demanding the right to bring it into the education. It's very strange, but it's the kind of contradiction that you can only get away with when you are the mainstream media. So take it away.
Yes, entirely so. In the United States, the objection is not so much that this is some specialized legal theory. It started among legal scholars, but in the United States, what they will say is, "Well, this is nothing more than an honest look at American history. This is an attempt not to sweep the crimes of American history under the carpet. The extermination of the Indians, so-called. Of course, the Indians were not exterminated. And the horrible treatment of Blacks through slavery, segregation, lynching, Jim Crow, all of that. In fact, it is considerably more than that. It is a view of the United States as being deliberately constructed as a white supremacist undertaking that continues to be white supremacist no matter what Americans individually say or do. This is a theory of racism without racists. That is what's meant by institutional racism or systemic racism. And when Joe Biden, in his sleepy way, talks about rooting out systemic racism, he's not even talking about individuals. He's somehow finding, grasping this ghostly miasma that torments the American mind, that's all out there entirely independently of what individual whites think. This, to me, is the essential character of critical race theory. It's a kind of a voodoo, really. There is a wickedness out there that has an almost independent existence. And so white people can be well-meaning. But as sometimes the critical race theorists will point out in the bluntest possible terms, it's not enough for white people to be race blind or color blind. Critical race theory requires that white people constantly be thinking about race, constantly attuning their thoughts and their actions when they are in the presence of non-whites, to the point that one of the most idiotic but quite popular slogans during the Black Lives Mania of 2020 was, "White silence is violence." Well, what on earth does that mean? That means when white people are not bellowing about the wickedness of their own race, if they're not talking about all the horrible things we've done to black people and all the wonderful things we should do to them, they are committing violence. Well, what sort of astonishing nonsense is this? It really ascribes to whites a kind of a superpower. You, millennial woes, but not saying the prescribed, not mouthing the prescribed mumbo jumbo about race and your own guilt, you are committing violence against blacks. Presumably, even in your sleep, you're committing violence. Good grief. I wish I had that kind of power.
I think some people would accuse me of that, to be honest.
Well, some people would. Some people would. That's the astonishing thing. So it's this kind of utterly preposterous nonsense. And the idea, as I said before, that white people, especially heterosexual white men and boys, that we are inherently wicked, that we are the cancer of human history, that from the year dot, all we've ever done is oppress and enslave and exterminate people who are unlike ourselves. This is really at the core of critical race theory. It's an attempt to keep the whitey perpetually on the hop. And when white people realize that this is stuff that's being taught to their fourth grade boys, and the boys have to get up in class and then list all the ways in which they are privileged, that they are oppressors, this is too much. Now, as I say, it would not have surprised me, given the supineness of white people for the last several decades, it would not have surprised me if this had just washed over them and they'd shrugged their shoulders and said, okay, yet another obstacle to life in the United States. But no, this has really infuriated people. So this seems to have been the straw. Well, it's not a straw. It's a pretty substantial block of wood that's broken the camel's back.
You see, I think that perhaps one of the reasons this has happened is that it's just so obviously, critical race theory seems to actually be the epitome of what white people have been trained to think is terrible, racism. It's critical race theory is essentially blaming an entire group of people, equating them all together, demonizing their history, their culture, their identity, them in the here and now. And even their genes in some sense, because it is an explicitly racial thing, and blaming them for all of society's ills. I mean, that is the definition of crass racism. It's what we were told that the Nazis did to the Jews, various other examples. And yet, I think white people are shocked to find that this is exactly what's now happening to them. And it's not even that it's happening to them that shocks them. It's just the thing in itself, that the unfairness of it, the unjust nature of it, that I think offends them.
Yes, that's certainly true. Although ever since the 1960s here in the United States, we have what goes under the somewhat benign sounding name of affirmative action, which is systematic institutional racism against whites. Even when I was applying to university in 1968, for heaven's sake, that's well before you and many of your listeners were born, it was taken for granted that if somehow we could have claimed to have been black or some other exotic hue, our chance of being admitted to university was so much better. Everyone understood that, even in 1968. And so white people have become almost accustomed to this. If you're going to try to get a job in a big company, you know the deck is stacked against you. We have tolerated this for a long, long time, nearly going on 50 years now. And so it would not have surprised me if we had once again tolerated this kind of teaching. I think what really did, as I say, really set the cat among the pigeons was the fact that here were white children being taught this, and their parents heard about it, and they said, well, enough is bloody enough. And I find that very encouraging. Now, this may be sooner than you want to change subjects, but another thing I find very encouraging is the upcoming presidential elections in France. As you probably know, the left has essentially collapsed. There's really practically nothing left of it. They've got an ecologist candidate. They've got a communist. They've got a hard left candidate who's been up, who's been in the presidential elections before. But now, who is really dominating the show? It's Marine Le Pen and this Algerian Jew who is really the staunchest white man of the group, Eric Zemmour. And then they also have a traditional conservative, Valérie Pécresse. Those people are absolutely dominating the debate, and the left is nowhere to be found. Now, Emmanuel Macron may continue to be, may end up being the final winner in the election after the second round. But I think the strength of people who used to be called and who are still called extreme right. They have dragged the entire debate in France into very sensible directions. Zemmour is just remarkable. I don't know if you were aware, but I think he spent 3.5 hours a couple of nights ago debating 10 people in a row. And this guy just cut them all to ribbons. One of the most remarkable things was his debate against a black woman who had served in some sort of governmental post under the socialists. And she says, well, we must recognize that it is in our origins and in the diversity of our origins that France finds its strength. He says, no, not at all. France is changing because of people like you. We don't want any more people like you in this country. She was shocked. She was practically in tears. But for someone to look a non-white person in the eye and say, look, you people are changing our country in unacceptable ways, and you're going to have to flourish where you were born. It takes a very unusual person to say that to a non-white. And Zemmour is one of those unusual people. Some people would say he wasn't even white himself. He's a Berber, and he came from Algeria as a child. But in any case, for a major candidate to actually be talking those terms in one of the, of course, most important countries in Western Europe, that this to me is yet another wonderful and very inspiring development. So I jumped across the pond, perhaps in a way that you didn't expect. But so despite all the horrible things that are happening, I see real signs that white people are waking up.
Well, in the case of Eric Zemmour, I agree with you. On the whole, I find it a sign of, it's a good sign, I think. There are obviously people who would rather that it were a real stereotypical Frenchman yes. who was doing this rather than, I think he's an Algerian Jewish guy.
Yes, yes.
I actually wonder if that's part of the reason that he's getting away with it, because and I know that he has been brought up on hate speech charges in the past, but nonetheless, yes. I suspect that he'd be getting a much tougher reception if he were, you know, stereotypically white, let's say.
Well, he is now a serious enough candidate so that I think the reception that he's getting and the beating that the lefties and the major media are trying to give him is really no different from what a Français de souche, that is to say, a white Frenchman of obvious French origins, would be getting. I don't think he's getting off at all now that he's become a serious announced candidate. Now, his chances of becoming elected president of France are probably very poor. On the other hand, in European elections, in the parliamentary systems we find there, it does appear that once what's called the extreme right, and of course these are people who just have common sense attitudes towards immigration and race, once common sense reaches the threshold of maybe 15 or 20%, then that forces the other parties to try to steal their clothes and move in somewhat more sensible directions. The fact that he has had the attention that he has, that he's getting these huge crowds to his rallies, that his books are just selling like nobody's business, and also the fact that Marine Le Pen of the former National Front, the fact that she continues to poll as either the number two or number three candidate of all those who are running for the presidential elections. If you throw all the right and so-called extreme right together, you've got a good 35-40% of the vote there. So this is an extraordinary phenomenon in France, where the left has always been very strong, where you've had outright socialist presidents, maybe just 7 or 8 years ago, for heaven's sake. The socialist party has collapsed into nothing. And it's not as though the ecologists have taken their place. And then there is this Jean-Luc Mélenchon guy who tries to wave the flag of the general, what we would call the progressive left. And they've got a sure enough communist. All of these people account for nothing, and they're going nowhere. This is a real change in a very important Western European country. So I hate to take the view that things have to get significantly worse for white people to wake up. That may be the case. I would like to think that people can wake up to the truth about race without having their wives raped, themselves mugged 3 times in a row. It does seem to be that many white people are so blinded by the media that they do have to have some sort of physical encounter with the nasty aspects of it. Even so, for whatever reason, I think that certainly in France and some other country that we could talk about, but certainly in France and in the United States, in the face of this absolute onslaught of explicitly anti-white action and ideology, people are waking up. Now, whether they wake up in time to do anything serious and significant about it, we'll see. But they're certainly waking up.
On the matter of Eric Zemmour, there's some other things that occur to me, because there are people in our circles who don't like him, don't trust him, don't trust his motivations, or the motivations of those who have facilitated him into this position. But what I would say about this, and you know, I'm a layman. You know far more about France than I do, and I know that you speak fluent French. Marine Le Pen. One of the things about that people say about Zemmour is that he's just there to prevent Marine Le Pen from getting ahead. It's to split the right wing vote or the nationalist vote, but as I understand it, Marine Le Pen has been very milquetoast for many years now. So it doesn't really, in that sense, this will force her to up her game, perhaps, but it will also defend her, because it means that she's not on her own anymore. She's not the only one saying these things. And indeed, I think in some ways he goes further than she does.
Of course he does. And that's one of his great appeals. Now, if people don't trust his motives, I can't read his mind. I can't tell you what his motives are. But the things that he's saying now about France and the need for France to remain French, and the point that he makes is that it is idiotic to distinguish between radical Islam and Islam. He says Islam itself is radical. It's all radical. It's incompatible with French history and a genuinely French future. He's been saying these things for years. He hasn't changed his tune just because he's a presidential candidate. He became a presidential candidate because he thought this was a message that would resonate with the French. And to a large degree, it has. Let us not forget that in the last presidential election, Marine Le Pen went into the second round and was trounced by Emmanuel Macron. I think it was something like 65, 30, or 70, 70%, 30%. She probably has no chance of winning. And it may very well be that Eric Zemmour has no chance of winning either. But his view is, not only is he saying what Marine Le Pen should be saying, he says, look, you have a party. It's called the Republican Party. They claim to be Gaullists. He says, listen to what actually Charles de Gaulle used to say. And he quotes Charles de Gaulle on the fact of France being a white Christian country. And Charles de Gaulle's hometown was Colombes les deux églises, which means Colombes of the two churches. And de Gaulle said, look, we don't want to be living in a country where we end up living in a place called Colombes, the two mosques. That's not the future of France that I want. He was quite explicit about this. And so even the generally acceptable right, the people who call themselves Gaullists, he calls them frauds. He says, I should be your candidate. If you really believe what General de Gaulle said about the future of France, I'm your candidate. I'm Marine Le Pen's candidate. I'm the people, all of the people who really think France should be French. And I see no reason to doubt his sincerity.
I mean, this is the thing. Even if he doesn't win, and even if his intentions aren't exactly what you would want them to be. And I don't, as you say, I don't see any reason to doubt that just now. But even then, he is explicitly defending not ethno-nationalism exactly, but definitely the saying that the French nation should protect the existence of the French people.
Yes.
I mean, it's incredible, actually, for a mainstream politician to be saying that in Europe in recent decades.
Oh, by all means. I would prefer also that his name be Pierre Dupont or something, not Eric Zemmour. But we need all the help we can get. And if an Algerian Jew is going to be the standard bearer for France, for the French, he's certainly saying all the things that I would absolutely want a candidate to say. And as I say, he's been saying these things for decades. I don't think he's playing any sort of game. And I really don't think that he's trying to kick Marine Le Pen out of the second round. If he does, it's because he's in the second round and he'll be facing Emmanuel Macron. And he is a very slick and well-informed debater. And as always, when you go into the second round of the presidential elections, the remaining two candidates have these televised debates. The last time, 5 years ago, when Marine Le Pen was facing Emmanuel Macron, he ran rings around her. It was really a sad performance on her part. She was hoydenish. She was aggressive. Utterly unnecessarily so. He pointed out all kinds of inconsistencies and the things that she was saying about the economy. Whereas Eric Zemmour, you can't trap him that way. He's a very bright, he's a very slick guy. So if he gets into the second round, Emmanuel Macron is going to have a very tough customer on his hand. Now, it is possible that I'm sure all of your viewers know that the way the French election works, you have all this bunch of candidates on the first round, and then the top two end up in the second round. They go toe-to-toe with each other. And the left is so hopelessly splintered that there is no chance, certainly at this point, of any of the lefty candidates going in. So either it's going to be Marine Le Pen or Eric Zemmour, or it's going to be this Republican lady, Valérie Pécresse, who, because of the popularity of Zemmour and Marine Le Pen, has been forced to say sensible things about race and immigration. It's going to be one of those three, unless something really, some surprising political earthquake takes place in France. I think, again, I see no reason to think that he's trying to keep some worthy candidate out of the second round. And probably, even if Marine Le Pen makes it in, she has, as you say, she's been extremely milquetoast. She has been trying to live down her father's reputation ever since she pushed him out of the party. And she has been trying to style herself as presidential. And to be presidential, you can't be extreme. And she has disappointed many of her most ardent supporters because of this. And they are defecting in droves to Zemmour. So we will see. Again, I would prefer that Zemmour was a sure enough bona fide centuries living in France kind of Frenchman. He's not, but I'll take what I can get.
Okay. There are two questions that I've posted in the private chat here. If you could have a look at them, I'm not sure if you would want to. One of them is a bit personal. I'm not sure if you'd want to answer those.
Have I ever had a Japanese girlfriend? To that questioner, I'd say, what's it to you? Jared, in Exum's book, he's very critical of Jewish society in France. What extent do you think that fact is Sephardic, that he's Sephardic impacts his view? You know, I don't know. I met Eric Zemmour once.
Let me just read this out so if you can answer it.
Yes,
Eric Zemmour is very critical of Jewish society in France in his book. To what extent do you think the fact that he's Sephardic impacts his views on this subject?
I don't have a good answer to the question of to what extent that he's Sephardic. I do know that certainly Jews in the United States, if they have an understanding of the importance of race and immigration, and if they care about the demographic future of either a Western European country or the West in general, they understand the aggregate role of their co-religionists. They understand very well that Jewish communities have been at the forefront of all these efforts to undermine any sense of moral legitimacy of white identitarianism. And so they're critical of that. And despite the fact that most of the Jews I know in this country, in fact, probably all of them, are Ashkenazi and not Sephardic. So I don't think that one has to be a Sephardic Jew in order to understand the role that organized Jewry has had in some of these essentially anti-white undertakings. So the fact that he is Sephardic, I don't know if that's important or not. The fact that he's Jewish probably does lend a certain urgency to his understanding of Islam. I would say that. And to me, this is one of the really quite astonishing things about organized Jewish organizations in Western Europe and also in the United States. They seem to think that diversity requires that we keep importing more and more Muslims. Muslims are certainly not going to treat them the way Christians do, despite their centuries-old delusions about how dangerous Christians are to Jews.
Okay. Oh, no, hold on a minute. There was one other question. If people do have any super chats for Jared, now would be the time to post them. Given what's stated in the legal definition of genocide, I think this is the UN definition, multiracialism is illegal because that would be because it threatens the continued existence of an ethnic group by in whole or in part and all this. Multiracialism is illegal. I find this to be a point that seriously needs to be brought up more. Thoughts, gentlemen? Happy Christmas.
There are a lot of people who try to describe what is happening to whites as genocide. And if you do stick to certain academic definitions of genocide, you could say that, yes, white people are in the first stages of genocide. However, and perhaps your viewer will be not unhappy with my answer, I don't think it is useful to claim that we are victims of genocide. Most people think of genocide as being rounded up and put into camps and exterminated. That's not happening to white people. And if you say we are victims of genocide, people will look around and they'll see very clearly that this isn't like the Hutu going after the Tutsi and macheting a million of them to death. This isn't happening. And so their view is going to be, well, this is a crazy idea. So yes, you can split hairs and say, according to this definition, this is genocide, but I don't think that that is a persuasive argument. I think you have to stick to the facts and simply describe what is happening and say it's wrong. To say it's genocide, to me, is when the other side says that what people like you and me say is racist. Oh, what does that mean? What does that really mean? Depends on how you define racism. And the same goes for trying to use words for their shock value to try to defend our positions, which I think are better defended simply by being logical, by drawing parallels to our experience as opposed to other people's experience, the terrible double standards we face, and simply the facts on the ground.
Okay. Yeah, I one of my earliest videos, and I think it was literally within the first set of five that I made, was called Genocide, We Need a New Word. Because, and I was making this point that even if it does fit the UN definition of genocide, and again, I wish I could remember the wording offhand. I used to know it. but I can't remember it now. But it's setting up conditions that threaten the existence in whole or in part of an ethnic group. Even if it does fit that, and I think it does, to tell people, to tell normies and whatever, that this is we're being genocided, it makes you sound alarmist. Yes. And also autistic and sort of pedantic and a bit mad, yes. Because their image of genocide in their head is lines of people being shot, being macheted, etc. And exactly. They know that that isn't happening, at least not yet. So they think, well, you're massively exaggerating what's happening. And then yes. You've also got the fact that the liberals, that the progressive, can say, but it's not genocide at all because it's happening by choice. So it's not even replacement. It's just blending together and, you know, this kind of hippie stuff.
Yes, yes. I think a better word for what's happening is another Frenchman, Renaud Camus' expression, the great replacement. If you refer to that phenomenon, that is to say the replacement of white people by non-white immigrants in large numbers, reducing us to a minority in the nations, sometimes, at least in the case of Europe, of our actual autochthonous origins. If you say that this is happening and you don't like it, you think it's a bad thing, then they'll pretend it's not even happening. But then, of course, if they discuss the changes in the population of, for example, the United States, they start gloating about how this is going to mean that the Democrats are going to be the permanent people in power and progressivism will triumph. So they can't have it both ways. They can't pretend that it's not happening if you're against it, but it is happening if you're in favor of it. But the point is, we are being displaced. We are being replaced. That you can say with complete confidence, and the statistics will bear you out. But to talk about genocide, I don't think it's useful for precisely the reasons you just described so well.
Oh, thank you. It just seems setting yourself up to be accused of alarmism, even though what you're saying is true. And I agree. It is, in effect, it amounts to a sort of peaceful stealth genocide. But to say that makes you sound crazy.
If one were to say that the simple fact of multiracialism is genocide, well then, at least in the United States, whites deliberately brought black people to this country. They deliberately came to a country that was already occupied by people of another race. Were they contemplating genocide right from the beginning? No. The fact of multiracialism, you could argue that if you take an original population that is native to an area and you start introducing people of other races over the wishes of the people who are living there, then you might conceivably call that a UN-defined genocide. But no, I think certainly in the case of the United States, multiracialism is something that was inevitable from the beginning when whites showed up, and white people just made it worse by importing not only Africans, but then after our immigration laws changed in 1965, immigrating every possible race from around the world.
And the other thing I wanted to bring up at the start that we really should address, even though it's not a positive, it's not an optimistic thing, but with it, we definitely should be addressed, is, and I might mispronounce this, the Waukesha massacre, or the Waukesha terrorist incident.
Waukesha, sorry.
Yes. Okay. So what would you have to say about that? Because it and I know it's sort of going back to saying the media lie, if the races had been reversed, etc. But yeah. Still, it does seem quite an astonishing example of this, because it's far worse than what James Alex Fields did in Charlottesville. And yet this guy, he's got 400 years in prison, whereas this guy is being it's been memory hold.
Well, I don't think he's going to see the light of day for a long, long time. But what is important, of course, is that this fellow whose name I don't even remember, if someone...
Daryl Brooks.
Yes, there you go. That just goes to show you how unsung an anti-hero he is. Whereas James Field or Dylann Roof, everyone knows those people. But no, a black guy, you see what they cling to in the media invariably is that unless there is the most explicit and avowed anti-white animus that the perpetrator himself expresses as a reason for killing or injuring, mowing down white people, then they will say, well, he was fleeing from the police and ended up in the wrong place, full of these Christmas parades.
Yeah.
Or they will tell you, well, he's got psychological problems. He's just round the twist.
The thing is, though, that he has expressed anti-white
animus,
but they're still going with those other things anyway. I mean, infuriating.
I've grown so inured to this. And earlier I was talking about the way the Washington Post talked about the arrest of these half a dozen blacks who are accused of committing hate crimes against Asians at the very time when the Washington Post has been wringing its hands over this uprising of anti-Asian hate and explicitly and implicitly blaming it on whites, and then is unable to bring themselves to say that this band of the worst possible perpetrators is, by the way, no, we won't even say that they're black. It's pathetic. But again, this is something that more and more people, even people who read the Washington Post, are seeing through. But no, the Waukesha thing, it's a particularly egregious example, as you say, but it's something over which we need no longer express any surprise, even though it does make us hopping mad.
Yeah, indeed. You said earlier that people are finding Amren and similar outlets despite the censorship. And obviously, we don't need to go on about how awful the censorship is. I think we've both talked about that, especially me, at length over the last few years. And you know, the audience know this very well. Could you go into how people are finding Amren? Do you know the routes by which they're finding it? And if not, could you go into why you think they're seeking it out?
I know that in some cases, people will send a link. When people find out about American Renaissance, somewhat to my dismay, more often than not, they will say, well, I saw this great video. Well, I'm not much of a fan of videos myself. I'd much rather read. I'm a Gutenbergian in that respect. But people like videos. And at the beginning of all of my videos, I've taken to saying, if you like this video, it's something that the internet is trying very, very, very hard to make impossible to find. So if you'd send a link to as many of your friends and even your enemies, please do so. So that's one route whereby people hear about us. But it's not the sort of thing that Joe Normie, just browsing around the internet in a usual casual way, they're not going to stumble onto Millennial Yule. They're not going to stumble onto any of our videos. And so the fact, I suppose I'm arguing backwards from the fact that our traffic is increasing, our views are increasing. This means that either we have people who are already coming to our sites and passing along the address to others, or you actually do have people who are riled up to the point that they are wanting to find out what the facts are. Does anybody have an explanation of what's going on that's not the standard liberal baloney? And they're finding us. That's really all I can tell you. Again, what people most often mention, something that brought us to us, it's a video. Nobody ever says, I read this great book that Jared Taylor wrote. No, I put a whole lot more effort into writing a book than doing making videos. But you know, that just seems to just, you might as well throw the books into a well and they sink without a bubble. It's videos that seem to attract people. And you're certainly more an online video presence than anything else. And that seems to be a very effective way to reach people. You know, I would much rather read something than listen to someone talk. I would much rather, if I were a millennial fan, I would probably prefer to read a a transcript rather than tune in and listen to you and me with only our mugs visible without any kind of supporting illustrations or videos. Talk about these things. That's just my nature. But that's not apparently the nature of a great many people that we're succeeding in reaching.
Well, I should, on that note, I should point out that there is somebody transcribing the each millennial stream. So, and if people want to help do that, I was surprised that somebody would do that. But
wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. I can't remember the Katana. I'll link to it in a while. But yeah, and if people want to help out with that, they can do that. But yes, I think you're right that people want that there is something unique about videos and the video format that people find comforting because they're accustomed to television, but they also find it very direct and easy.
I will draw you a parallel. I used to play in a dance band, and I played clarinet and saxophone pretty well, if I say so myself. And we were a pretty popular band. We had about maybe 50 engagements a year. So that's a lot of playing. And I had spent years learning how to play these instruments. But there were a few songs that I would sing. I would get up and I'd get behind the microphone and I'd sing Basin Street Blues or Slow Boat to China. And I would get uproarious applause compared to my standing up and playing what I thought was a damn good solo on a clarinet or the saxophone. There's something about the directness of the voice of people talking, that there's a kind of connection there that seems to reach into people's hearts in a way that the written word or even just a solo instrument, it just doesn't get to the same level somehow.
Even when it's you, Anglo-Saxon.
Yes, even us undemonstrative, cold-blooded, cold-fish Anglo-Saxons. We somehow
I'm referencing the joke about there was footage of you playing the saxophone, and somebody said, "Oh, this is some real Anglo-Saxon." Saxon.
Yes, anyway, Anglo-Saxon. Yes,
I think you shared it on Twitter. I have to ask, is there any footage of you playing in a jazz band? That seems incredible.
You know, I don't think there is. I should have. I have an audio recording. It would be great to have a nice video of me belting out some song and getting a rousing ovation. But no, there is no such thing, I fear.
So somebody writes, Uncle Jared never ceases to amaze.
I'm not sure that's a compliment. I will take it as one, however.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. Okay, let me see that there were two other questions. Yes. Now, I'm not sure what the answer of this might be. Someone says, thanks, Mr. Taylor. How is Colin Flaherty of Undeniable Truth getting on?
Oh, boy. He was scheduled to speak at the American Renaissance Conference about a month ago, and he was unable to come because he is at a critical stage in a battle with cancer. And I will say no more than that. Colin Flaherty is really a great man. He has used video very, very well. He's reached an enormous number of people. His books have been very popular, and he's really a great man. And I hope that he will be back on video and writing books, but I cannot say that I am especially confident that he will be. But thank you so much for asking. He's really a wonderful man, and I'm sorry I had never invited him to speak at an American Renaissance Conference before, and it was a terrible pity that he wasn't able to come.
Right, okay. And then a final question, unless there are any forthcoming. This comes from Grunge Muffin, and that is, why can't normies who would have once supported the Free Tibet movement see the inherent contradiction in condemning the people speaking out for white homelands in the West, and especially Europe?
I don't know. I've been cudgeling my brains trying to come up with an answer to that question or a variant on it for the last 30, 35 years. It's really without historical precedent that people who have the power and an obvious interest in maintaining a majority status in their homelands are voluntarily giving it up, and who, as you say, are happy to line up behind the demands of absolutely any other group of people who want to have a homeland, and yet who are incapable of lifting a finger to defend their own homelands. There are lots and lots of theories about this. And if we wanted to just have a conversation about what accounts for this, I have half a dozen different reasons why whites would do this, none of which, either in isolation or in combination, to my mind, is a satisfactory explanation. Something is happening here that I think must reflect a kind of pathological altruism that has developed over the millennia in white people, and other people have figured out exactly how to exploit it. And if we don't get control of this, we really are marching towards the precipice. But I don't have a really satisfactory answer for that question.
Okay. And then one final super chat, which I Janet, do you think America will collapse? And if so, when?
You know, I've been thinking for a whole host of irrelevant reasons about Egypt. You know, Egypt, it was first unified around 3000 BC. And it wasn't taken over by the Romans until about 50 BC, I guess. So you've got 2,500 years, almost 3,000 years of Egyptian continuity. Now, you had various internal conflicts. You had a few invasions, didn't last forever. You've got 3,000 years of Egyptian history. It is astonishing that they managed to hold together as long as they did. The United States, we celebrated 200 years of the United States in 1976. I would be not at all surprised if the United States ceases to exist as the entity that is today within the next maybe 30 or 40 years. It's very hard to predict specifically when some kind of breakup will take place, but I just can't see it holding together. It's composed of too many, not only different, but increasingly hostile groups. I don't believe the United States has been riven by the kind of bitter, visceral hostility of this level anytime since before the American Civil War that broke out in 1861. This is the kind of mentality that can lead to secession. So it would not surprise me at all if the United States were to break up in some fashion. When it'll happen, I think it's probably foolish to make any predictions, but I don't expect the United States to survive, certainly not another 50 years in this form, but we'll see. It could. I mean, after all, take a country like Brazil. Brazil just continues to stagger on despite all the difficulties it has with its divided population. But the United States really, as I say, has reached a level where there is just such this knocking, this butting of heads. It's nonstop. And not only is it racial, it's ideological, to the point where I just don't know whether a social fabric can hold up with all of these tearing forces applied to it.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you saying this, because it does seem to be something that's being said more and more now. And actually, someone told me the percentages. There was a poll done of both Democrat voters and Republican voters. I think it's 67% of Republican voters want the US to split.
That's
right. Secede. And I think it might have been 40% of Democrats. I can't remember that one.
Even Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, he's saying he could see a day when Texas would simply have to secede. This is pretty wild talk coming from a United States senator. But after all, people understand the concept of divorce, and divorce need not even have the legal requirements which it once required, some kind of in flagranto delicti, infidelity, for example. People can get divorces on the basis of irreconcilable differences. And if you were to do a study of American race relations, I think you'd be justified in concluding that we have irreconcilable differences. And if you look at the right and the left today, I think that those differences are increasingly irreconcilable. And the most satisfactory solution for everyone involved would be just to get as far away from each other as possible.
Yeah. It does seem both racial reasons, but also especially now ideological reasons. It seems that
yes.
we just can't coexist with the left and their pet projects.
And they're the ones who are so intolerant. They're the ones who wish to cancel us. They're the ones who wish to stop us even from meeting in Hove and having conferences. They're the ones who insist that we are not merely wrong, that we are immoral. The champions of diversity and the champions of tolerance are remarkably intolerant of any diversity of views. So it seems to me the venom is coming largely from the left, but I certainly don't discount the venom coming to the right as well. Also, there is an utter unwillingness on both sides to accept that those who disagree with them may be doing so with good motives. Now, I was once a liberal. I have been related to liberals. There are liberals whom I love, and most liberals, I mean, I don't know up at the top, these people who make a living being a liberal, but most liberals, they're well-meaning. And I suppose because I have spent 35 years having my motives questioned and people claiming to read my mind and know what it is that drives me, and I'm fed up with it. But I think that's something that is increasingly common on the right as well. People say, well, Angela Merkel must hate Germany. She wants to destroy Germany. Well, no. She's got other reasons for doing what she wants to do. And I think what most liberals, they really do think they're doing the right thing. They're being generous. They're being good. They're being tolerant. They love diversity, or so they do, so long as somebody else has to live with the consequences. So this utter unwillingness, even to take people's motives as they are expressed, this is something that now goes both ways. And eventually, if you can't even discuss, then you just have to walk away. And that's the sign, I think, of a marriage that's beyond salvation. It can't be salvaged. If they can't even talk about their problems, if all they do is yell, well, then it's time to leave.
All right. Well, on that ominous yet strangely optimistic note, Jared Taylor, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2021.
I guess it's time for me to leave.
Well, yeah, but not due to irreconcilable differences, you know.
No, of course not.
I just don't want to take up too much of your time.
Of course,
and there is also the next guest.
Of course. No, we must not. We must not slop into the time reserved for others. Well, thank you so much for this opportunity, and you know, I greatly admire your work, and I wish you every success in the years to come, and may there be many of them.
Well, thank you very much. You're always one of the most popular and requested guests. So thank you for agreeing to appear.
It's been my pleasure.
Okay. I'll be back very soon with the next stream. Bye-bye for now.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.